Chapter 9. Liquid Oxygen. I had been lying in the dark room, in a trance, staring at the illuminated face of the watch on my wrist for I don't know how long. I was listening to my own breathing and feeling surprised at something, but all of this, the staring at the greenish ring of figures and the surprise, was steeped in an indifference I put down to exhaustion. I turned on my side. The bed was oddly wide. Something was missing. I held my breath. There was absolute silence. I froze. Not the slightest whisper came from anywhere. Hare? Why couldn't I hear her breathing? I felt the bedding with my hand. I was alone. Hare? I was about to call out, but I heard footsteps. It was someone large and heavy, like... Gabarian, I said calmly.
Yes, it's me. Don't turn the light on.
Really?
There's no need. That way it will be better for both of us.
But you're dead.
It doesn't matter. I mean, you do recognize my voice.
Yes. Why did you do it?
I had to. You were 4 days late. If you'd gotten here sooner, it might not have been necessary, but don't feel bad.
I'm fine. Are you really here?
Oh, you think you're dreaming, like you thought about Harry. Where is she?
What makes you think I know? I'm guessing you do.
Keep that thought to yourself. Let us say I'm here instead of her.
I want her to be here as well.
That's not possible.
Why not? Look, you do know that really it's not you, it's me, right?
No, it's really me. If you wanted to be pedantic, you could say it's me again, but let's not waste words.
Will you go away?
Yes.
And then she'll come back?
Is that what you want?
What is she to you?
That's my business.
But you're afraid of her?
No, I'm not.
And disgusted by her? What do you want from me? You can feel sorry for yourself, but not for her. She's always going to be 20 years old. Don't pretend you don't know that.
All of a sudden, I have no idea why, I calmed down. I listened to him with equanimity. I had the impression he was standing ever closer at the foot of the bed, but I still couldn't see anything in the darkness. What are you after? I asked, quietly. My tone seemed to surprise him. He was silent for a moment.
Sartorius has convinced Snout that you hoodwinked him. Now they're doing the same to you. They're pretending to assemble the X-ray equipment, but they're actually building a field annihilator.
Where is she? I asked.
Did you not hear what I just said to you? I'm trying to warn you.
Where is she?
I don't know. Listen up. You'll need a weapon. You can't count on anyone.
I can count on Harry, I said. I heard a low, rapid sound. He was laughing.
Sure you can, up to a certain point. In the end, you can always do what I did.
You're not Gabarian.
How do you like that? And who am I? A dream of yours, maybe?
No, they're puppet, but you don't know it.
And how do you know who you are?
That made me think. I wanted to get up, but I couldn't. Gabarian was saying something. I couldn't understand the words. I only heard the sound of his voice. I was struggling desperately with the weakness of the flesh. I made one more colossal effort, jerked my body, and woke up. I gasped for air like a half-suffocated fish. It was completely dark. It had been a dream. A nightmare. But just a moment.
A dilemma we're not able to resolve. We persecute our own selves. All Pelletheria did was apply a kind of selective amplifier to our thoughts. Seeking motivation for this is anthropomorphism. Where there are no humans, there are none of the motives available to humans. To continue the projected research, we'd have to destroy either our own thoughts or the material realization. The former is beyond our powers. The latter looks too much like murder.
In the darkness, I listened to the distant, measured voice that I had recognized at once. It was Gabarian. I stretched out my hand. The bed was empty. "I've woken into another dream," I thought. "Gabarian?" I said. The voice broke off at once in mid-word. There was a soft click, and I felt a faint puff of air on my face. "Really, Gabarian," I muttered with a yawn, "following someone from one dream into another, come off it." There was a rustling sound next to me. "Gabarian," I repeated more loudly. The bedsprings moved.
"Chris, it's me,"
came a whisper right by me.
"Oh, it's you, Harry. Well, where's Gabarian?"
Chris, surely he's... You yourself said he died."
"Well, he might be alive in a dream,"
I said slowly. I was no longer at all certain it had been a dream.
"He was saying something. He was here,"
I added. I was fearfully sleepy. If I'm sleepy, I must be asleep, I thought to myself, idiotically. I brushed Hari's cold arm with my lips and arranged myself more comfortably. She said something in reply, but I was already plunged in oblivion. In the morning, in the red sunlight of the room, I recalled the events of the night. The conversation with Gabarian had been a dream, but the things that had happened next... I'd heard his voice, I could have sworn it. I just didn't quite remember what he'd been saying. It hadn't sounded like a conversation, more like a lecture. A lecture! Harry was getting washed. I heard the splash of water in the bathroom. I looked under the bed where I'd shoved the tape recorder a few days before. It wasn't there. "Harry!" I called. Her face dripping water appeared from behind the locker. "You didn't see a tape recorder under the bed by any chance, did you? A little pocket-sized one?"
"There were various things under there. I put them all over on that shelf."
She pointed to near the medicine cabinet and vanished back into the bathroom. I jumped out of bed, but I couldn't find what I was looking for. "You must have seen it," I said when she came back into the main room. She combed her hair in front of the mirror and didn't reply. It was only now I noticed she was pale, and that when her eyes met mine in the mirror, there was a searching look in them. "Harry," I began again insistently, "the tape recorder isn't on the shelf."
"You don't have anything more important to tell me?"
"I'm sorry," I murmured. "You're right, it's not that big of a deal." That was all we needed, to start an argument. After that, we went to get breakfast. Harry was doing everything differently than usual that day, but I couldn't put my finger on what exactly had changed. She was looking closely at everything around her. A couple of times, she didn't hear what I was saying to her, as if she'd suddenly gotten lost in thought. One time, when she raised her head, I saw her eyes were glistening. "What's wrong?" I asked, lowering my voice to a whisper. "Are you crying?"
"Let it be. They're not real tears,"
she stammered. Perhaps I shouldn't have left it at that, but there was nothing I was so afraid of as heart to hearts. Besides, I had other things on my mind. Though I knew Snout and Sartorius's scheming had only been a dream, I'd begun to wonder if there was some kind of handy weapon on the station. I'd no idea what I would do with it. I just wanted to have it. I told Harry I needed to swing by the hold and the depositories. She followed me in silence. I searched among the crates and rifled through the capsules. Then, when I went all the way down to the lowest floor, I couldn't resist the temptation to look in on the cold room. I didn't want Harry to go in there, though, so I just half opened the door and checked the whole place over with my eyes. The dark shroud bulged over the elongated figure beneath, but from where I was standing I couldn't tell if the black woman was still lying where she had been. It seemed to me that her place was empty. I didn't find anything I could use, and I was in an ever-worsening mood as I wandered about, till all at once I realized I couldn't see Harry. She appeared right after that. She stayed back in the corridor, yet the very fact she tried to distance herself from me, something that was so hard for her even for a moment, should have made me think. But I was still acting offended at no one in particular, or just generally behaving like a jerk. I'd gotten a headache, I couldn't find any aspirin, and, mad as hell, I tipped out the entire contents of the first aid kit. I couldn't be bothered to go back to the surgery. I'd rarely been such a mess as I was that day. Harry was moving about the cabin like a shadow. From time to time she'd disappear. In the afternoon, after we'd eaten lunch, though in fact she rarely ate at all, while I'd lost my appetite from the headache and didn't even press her to have something, all of a sudden she sat down next to me and began picking at the sleeve of my shirt. "How's it going?" I murmured absently. I had an urge to go upstairs because I had the impression the pipes were carrying a faint echo of knocking sounds, meaning that Sartorius was tinkering with the high-tension apparatus. But I lost interest when it occurred to me that I'd have to go with Hare, whose presence might have been semi-understandable in the library, but there, among the machinery, might have led Snout to make some inopportune remark.
"Chris," she whispered, "how are things between us?"
I gave a sigh despite myself. I can't say it was a happy day for me. Couldn't be better. Why do you ask?
"I wanted to have a talk with you."
"Fire away."
"Not that kind of talk."
"Then what kind? Like I said, I got a headache. I've all kinds of things on my mind."
"A little goodwill, Chris."
I forced myself to smile. It couldn't have been impressive.
"What is it, darling? I'm listening."
"Will you tell me the truth?"
I raised my eyebrows. I didn't like this as an opener. "Why would I lie?"
"You might have reasons, serious ones. But if you want there to be, you know, then don't lie to me."
I said nothing.
"I'll tell you something, and you'll tell me something, okay? It'll be the truth, regardless of anything else."
I wasn't looking her in the eye. She sought my gaze, but I pretended not to notice.
"I already told you that I don't know how I got here. But maybe you know. Wait, I haven't finished. Maybe you don't know. But if you know, and it's just that you're not able to tell me now, then will you later, one day? That won't be the worst thing. In any case, you'll give me a chance."
I had the sensation of an icy current running through my entire body.
"What are you saying, kid? What chance?" I mumbled.
"Chris, whoever I am, I'm for sure no kid. You promised. Tell me."
That whoever I am gave me such a lump in my throat that all I could do was stare at her, shaking my head like an idiot, as if I were trying to prevent myself from hearing everything.
"I already said you don't have to tell me. It's enough for you to say you can't."
"I'm not hiding anything," I answered hoarsely.
"Very good, then,"
she replied, standing up. I wanted to say something. I sensed I shouldn't leave her like that, but all the words stuck in my throat. "Hare..." She was by the window, her back to me. The empty, dark blue ocean lay beneath a bare sky.
"Hare, if you think that... Hare, you know I love you." "You love me?"
I went up to her. I tried to put my arms around her. She freed herself, pushing my hand aside.
"You're so good," she said. "You love me. I'd rather you beat me." "Hare, darling... No, no. Best just don't say a thing."
She went up to the table and began clearing away the plates. I stared into the dark, blue emptiness. The sun was starting to set, and the great shadow of the station moved evenly on the waves. A plate slipped out of Hare's hands and fell on the floor. Water sounded in the sinks. At the edges of the horizon, the ruddy color turned to a dirty reddish gold. If only I knew what to do. Oh, if only I knew... All at once, things went quiet. Hare came and stood right by me.
"No, don't turn around,"
she said, lowering her voice to a whisper.
"None of this is your fault, Chris. I know it. Don't worry."
I reached out my hand towards her. She escaped to the other side of the cabin, and picking up a whole pile of plates, she said,
"Pity. If they could be broken, I'd smash them. I really would smash all of them."
For a moment I thought she was actually going to fling them to the ground, but she threw me a keen glance and smiled.
"Don't be scared. I'm not going to make a scene."
I woke up in the middle of the night, instantly intent and watchful. I sat up in bed. The room was dark, though a faint light came from the corridor through the cracked-open door. There was a nasty hissing sound that was intensifying, and at the same time there were dull, stifled thuds, as if something large were thrashing about in the next room. "A meteor," came a rapid thought. "It's broken through the armor plating. Someone's there." There was a prolonged wheezing. I finally regained my senses. It was the station, not a rocket. And that awful noise... I ran into the corridor. The door to the small lab was wide open and the light was on. I heard inside. I was struck by a wave of fearful cold. The cabin was filled with vapor that turned my breath to snow. A mass of white flakes were spinning over a body wrapped in a bathrobe that was lying on the floor and tossing weakly. I could barely see her through the icy cloud. I rushed up to her, picked her up. The robe burned my hands. She was rasping. I ran back into the corridor, past a series of doors. I no longer felt the cold, except that the breath coming out of her mouth in clouds of condensation scorched my neck like fire. I laid her on the table, tore open the robe over her breasts. For a moment I looked at her drawn, trembling face. The blood had frozen on her open lips, covering them with a dark coating. Tiny ice crystals glittered on her tongue. Liquid oxygen. There was liquid oxygen in the shop, in Dewar flasks. As I picked her up, I'd felt broken glass underfoot. How much could she have swallowed? It made no difference. Her trachea was burned, and her throat and lungs. Liquid oxygen is more caustic than any concentrated acid. Her breathing, raucous and dry as the sound of paper being torn, was growing shallower. Her eyes were closed. It was the death throes. I looked at the large glass-paneled cabinets with instruments and medications. Tracheotomy and intubation, except she had no lungs, they were burned up. Medication. There were so many different kinds. The shelves were filled with colored bottles and packets. The wheezing sound filled the whole room. Vapor was still coming from her open mouth. Hot water bottles. I started looking for them, but before I found any, I darted across to the other cabinet and began rifling through boxes of ampoules. Now I found a needle, which I fumbled to put in the sterilizer, my fingers stiff with cold and clumsy. I hammered furiously on the lid of the sterilizer, but I couldn't even feel it. The only sensation was a slight tingling. She made a louder, wheezing sound. I hurried over to her. Her eyes were open.
Hurry!
It wasn't even a whisper. I couldn't speak. Her face was alien, as if made of plaster. It brought me up sharp. Her ribs were twitching under her white skin. Her hair, wet from melting snow, lay scattered around her head. She was looking at me.
Hurry.
I was unable to say any more. I stood there like a lump of wood with those unwieldy foreign hands of mine. My feet, lips, eyelids were starting to sting ever more painfully, but I barely felt it. A droplet of blood that had melted in the heat ran down her cheek, leaving a diagonal mark. Her tongue quivered and disappeared. She was still rasping. I took her wrist. She had no pulse. I pulled apart the lapels of the robe and placed my ear against the fearfully cold body right beneath her breast. Through a crackling roar like a fire, I heard a pit-a-pat, a galloping sound too fast to count. I stood there leaning over her, my eyes closed, when something touched my head. She had dug her fingers into my hair. I looked into her eyes.
"Chris,"
she croaked. I grasped her hand in mine. She squeezed it back, almost crushing it. Consciousness was ebbing from her horribly distorted face. The whites of her eyes flashed beneath her eyelids. There was a snort from her throat, and her whole body was shaken by convulsions. I was barely able to hold on to her as she hung over the side of the table. She knocked her head against the side of a porcelain funnel. I pulled her up and pressed her to the table. With each new spasm, she tugged away from me. I immediately became drenched in sweat. My legs felt like cotton wool. When the convulsions eased off, I tried to lie her down again. She was making a squeaking sound as she gasped for air. All of a sudden, Hari's eyes lit up in that terrible, bloody face.
"Chris,"
she gasped.
How much longer, Chris?"
She began to choke. Foam appeared on her lips, and the convulsions began again. I held her down with all the strength I had left. She collapsed on her back so abruptly her teeth clattered. She was panting.
"No, no, no,"
she exclaimed rapidly with each out-breath. Each one seemed it would be the last. But the convulsions returned again, and once more she writhed in my arms, in the short pauses drawing in air with such an effort her ribcage bulged. Finally, her eyelids dropped halfway over her open, unseeing eyes. She stopped moving. I thought it was the end. I didn't even try to wipe the pink foam from her lips. I stood over her, leaning forward, hearing some great distant bell, and waited for her last breath, so that after it I could crumple onto the floor. But she kept on breathing, only slightly wheezing, ever quieter, and the tip of her breast, which had almost stopped quivering, began to move to the quick rhythm of a working heart. I stood hunched over her, and her face began to regain color. I still didn't understand a thing. The palms of both my hands grew moist, and I felt I was going deaf, that something soft and springy was filling my ears. I could still hear the ringing bell, which now sounded hollow, like with a broken heart. She raised her eyelids, and our eyes met. "Hurry," I tried to say, but I seemed to have no mouth. My face was a heavy, lifeless mask, and all I could do was look. Her eyes ran around the room. Her head moved. Everything was completely quiet. Behind me, in another far-off world, water was dripping regularly from a tap that hadn't been properly turned off. She rose on one elbow. She sat up. I drew back. She was watching me.
"So," she said. "So? It didn't work? Why not? Why are you looking at me like that?"
And suddenly, with a terrible scream,
"Why are you looking at me like that?"
Silence fell. She looked at her hands, wiggled her fingers.
"Is this me?"
she asked.
"Hurry,"
I said without breath, merely moving my lips. She raised her head.
"Hurry,"
she repeated. She slid down slowly onto the floor and stood up. She staggered, regained her balance, took a few steps. All this she did in a kind of daze, looking at me but seemingly without seeing me.
"Hurry,"
she repeated slowly one more time.
"But I'm not Hurry. And who am I? Hurry? And you? You?"
Suddenly her eyes opened wide, flashed, and the shadow of a smile of utter astonishment lit up her face.
"Maybe you too, Chris. Maybe you too?"
I said nothing, leaning back against a locker where fear had driven me. She dropped her arms.
"No,"
she said.
"No, because you're afraid. Listen to me, though. I can't do it. This isn't right. I didn't know anything about it. I still don't get it even now. I mean, surely it's not possible."
She clenched her fists so tight they turned white and pressed them to her chest.
"I don't know anything except Hurry. Do you think I'm pretending, maybe? I'm not pretending. Cross my heart, I'm not."
Her last words turned into a groan. She slumped to the floor, sobbing. What she had shouted had shattered something inside of me. In one long stride, I reached her and seized her in my arms. She fought back, pushing me away, sobbing without tears, exclaiming,
"Let me go. Let me go. I disgust you. I know. I don't want things this way. I don't. You see it. You know you do. That it's not me. Not me. Not me."
"Quiet," I cried, shaking her. We were both screaming, on our knees, facing one another. Hari's head was thrashing, knocking against my shoulder. I pulled her to myself with all my strength. All of a sudden, we were still, breathing heavily. Water was dripping evenly from the faucet.
"Chris,"
she mumbled, pressing her face into my arm,
"tell me what I need to do so I won't be there anymore, Chris."
"Stop it!" I yelled. She raised her face, stared at me.
"What do you mean? You don't know either. There's nothing can be done. Nothing?"
"Hurry, for pity's sake.
I wanted to. You saw. No, no, let me go. I don't want you to touch me. I disgust you."
"That's not true."
"You're lying. I must disgust you. I disgust myself as well. If I could, if I only could."
"You'd kill yourself."
"Yes."
"But I don't want that, you understand? I don't want you to kill yourself. I want you to be here with me. I don't need anything else." Her huge gray eyes devoured me.
"If you're lying,"
she said ever so softly. I let go of her and stood up. She sat back.
"Yes.
But I don't want that, you understand? I don't want you to kill yourself. I want you to be here with me. I don't need anything else. Her huge gray eyes devoured me.
If you're lying,
she said ever so softly. I let go of her and stood up. She sat back on the floor. Tell me what I need to do to make you believe I'm saying what I think. That it's the truth, that there's no other.
You can't say the truth. I'm not Hari.
Then who are you? She was silent for a long while. Her chin twitched over and over till she lowered her head and whispered,
Hari, but I know that that isn't true. It's not me. That you loved back then, long ago.
Yes, I said. What was then is dead and gone. But you, here, I love. You understand? She shook her head.
You're good. Don't think I don't appreciate all that you've done. You did the best you could, but it can't be helped. When I sat by your bed in the early morning 3 days ago, waiting for you to wake up, I didn't know a thing. That seems such a very long time ago. I was acting like I wasn't all there. It was like my head was filled with fog. I didn't remember what had come earlier and what had come later, and nothing surprised me. It was like coming round after anesthetic, or recovering from a long illness. I even thought maybe I'd been sick, and it was just that you wouldn't tell me. Then later, more and more things made me wonder. You know which things. I already had an inkling after the conversation you had in the library with that what's-his-name snout. And since you wouldn't say anything, I got up in the night and played the tape recorder. I only lied that one time, because I hid it afterwards, Chris. What was the name of the man who was talking on it?
Gibarion.
Right, Gibarion. At that moment, I understood everything, though, truth be told, I still didn't understand anything. There was one thing I didn't know, that I couldn't, that I wasn't, that it would end without an end. He didn't say anything about that, though maybe he did, but you woke up, and I turned off the tape. Even so, I heard enough to find out that I'm not a person, but an instrument.
What are you talking about?
That's right, to test your reactions or something like that. Each of you has something like me. It's based on memories or on the imagination. It's suppressed, something along those lines. Besides, you know all this better than I do. He said such terrible, inconceivable things. If it hadn't all added up, I don't think I would have believed him.
What added up?
You know that I don't need sleep, and I always have to be by you. Yesterday morning, I still thought you hated me, and that made me sad. Good Lord, how stupid I was. But tell me yourself, could I have imagined this? I mean, he didn't hate that woman of his at all, but the things he said about her... It was only then I understood that whatever I might do, it made no difference. Because whether I want it or not, it must be torture for you. Or actually, even worse, because a torture implement is as lifeless and innocent as a rock that can fall and kill you. But an implement that could have good intentions and could love. This I couldn't imagine. I'd like to tell you at least what went on inside me then, later, when I understood, when I listened to the tape. It might at least come in useful for you. I even tried to write it down.
Is that why you turned on the light? I asked. I suddenly felt choked. I had difficulty speaking.
Yes, but nothing came of it. Because I was searching inside myself, you know, for them, for that something else. I was completely mad, I can tell you. For a while I had the feeling that I didn't have a body under my skin, that... Inside me there was something else, that I was only a surface, there to fool you. You follow?
I do.
When you lie for hours through the night like that, in your thoughts, you can go very far and in very strange directions, you know.
I know.
But I could feel my heart. And besides, I remembered that you'd tested my blood. What's my blood like? Tell me the truth.
Surely you can now. It's the same as mine.
Really?
I swear.
What does that mean? You know, later it occurred to me that maybe it is hidden inside me. That it's... I mean, it could be very small. But I didn't know where. Now I think that at bottom I was dodging the issue because I was terrified of what I planned to do, and I was looking for another way out. But, Chris, if I have the same blood, if it's the way you say, then... No, that's not possible. I mean, I'd be dead already, wouldn't I? That means there is something after all, but where is it? Maybe in my head? Yet my thoughts are completely ordinary, and I don't know anything. If I were thinking through it, I ought to know everything right away and not love you, just pretend and know that I'm pretending. Chris, please tell me all you know. Maybe something can be done after all.
What could be done? She was silent. Do you want to die?
I think so.
Once again there was silence. I stood above her as she sat there, hunched over. I stared at the empty interior of the room, the white enameled surfaces of the apparatus, at the shining, scattered implements, as if I were searching for something terribly necessary and I couldn't find it.
Hari, can I say something, too?
She waited. It's true that you're not entirely like me, but that doesn't mean you're worse. Quite the opposite. Well, you can think any way you like about it, but it's thanks to that you survived. A kind of pathetic, childlike smile appeared on her face.
Is that supposed to mean I'm immortal?
I don't know. In any case, you're a lot less mortal than me.
How awful,
she whispered. Maybe not as much as you think.
But you don't envy me.
Hare, it's more a question of your purpose, as I might call it. You know, here on the station, your purpose is essentially as mysterious as mine, as that of any of us. The other men are going to continue Gibarian's experiment, and anything could happen.
Or nothing.
Or nothing. And to be honest, I'd rather it was nothing. Not even because I'm afraid, though I guess that plays a part, I'm not sure, but because it won't do any good. That's the one thing I'm certain of.
It won't do any good. Why not? Is it about the ocean?
She shuddered. That's right. It's about contact. In my view, the whole thing is in essence extremely simple. Contact means an exchange of experiences, concepts, or at least results, conditions. But what if there's nothing to exchange? If an elephant isn't a very large bacterium, then an ocean can't be a very large brain. Of course, various actions can be performed by both sides. As a result of one of them, I'm looking at you right now and trying to explain to you that you're more precious to me than the 12 years of life I devoted to Solaris, and that I want to go on being with you. Perhaps your appearance was meant to be torture, perhaps a reward, or perhaps just a test under a microscope. An expression of friendship, a treacherous blow, perhaps a taunt. Perhaps everything at once, or, as seems most likely to me, something entirely different. But what can you and I really care about the intentions of our parents, however different they were from one another? You can say that our future depends on those intentions, and I'd agree with you. I can't predict what's to come, nor can you. I can't even assure you I'll always love you. If so much has already happened, then anything can happen. Maybe tomorrow I'll turn into a green jellyfish. It doesn't depend on me. But in what does depend on us, we'll be together. Is that not something?
Listen, she said. There's one other thing. Am I really like her?
You were, I said. But now I don't know anymore.
What do you mean?
She got to her feet and looked at me with eyes wide open. You've already taken her place.
And you're sure it's not her, but me that you... Me?
Yes, you. I don't know. I'm afraid that if you were really her, I'd not be able to love you.
Why not?
Because I did something terrible.
To her?
Yes, when we were...
Don't say.
Why not?
Because I want you to know that I'm not her.
Chapter 10. A Conversation. The next day, when I came back from lunch, I found a note from Snout on the table by the window. He reported that for the moment, Sartorius was holding off with work on the Annihilator,
so as to make one last attempt at irradiating the ocean with a bundle of hard rays. "Darling," I said, "I have to go see Snout." The red dawn was blazing in the window panes and dividing the room in two. We were in the pale blue shadow. Beyond its border, everything looked like it was made of copper. You might have thought each book would clang if it fell from the shelf. "It's about the experiment, but I'm not sure how to go about it. You understand? I'd rather..."
"There's no need to explain yourself, Chris. I so wish I could. Maybe if it didn't last long?"
"I'll have to take a little while," I said. "Listen, how about you go with me and wait in the corridor?"
"All right. But if it's too much for me?"
"What's it actually like?" I said, adding quickly. "I'm not asking out of curiosity, you understand, but maybe if you figured it out, you could overcome it yourself."
"It's fear," she said.
She turned a little pale.
"I can't even say what it is I'm afraid of, because really I'm not afraid. I just lose myself. At the last moment, I also feel this shame I can't explain. Then nothing more. That's why I thought it was some kind of illness."
She finished more quietly and shuddered. "And perhaps it's only that way on this damn station," I said. "As for me, I'm going to do everything I can for us to leave here as soon as we can."
"Do you think that's possible?"
she said, opening her eyes wide. "Why not? I mean, I'm not shackled to the place. Though it'll also depend on what I decide with Snout. What do you think? Will you be able to be alone for long?"
"It depends," she said slowly. She lowered her head. "So long as I can hear your voice, I should be fine."
"I'd rather you didn't hear what we were saying. Not that I have anything to hide from you, but I don't know. I can't know what Snout will say."
"Say no more, I understand. All right, I'll put myself somewhere where I can only hear the sound of your voice. That'll do."
"Then I'll call him right away from the lab. I'll leave the door open." She nodded. I walked through the wall of red rays and out into the corridor, which, from the contrast, seemed almost pitch black, despite the artificial lighting. The door of the small laboratory was wide open, the reflective shards of the Dewar flask lying on the floor by the row of large liquid oxygen cylinders were the last signs of the nighttime events. The small screen lit up when I took the receiver and called the radio station. The bluish membrane of light that seemed to coat the lusterless glass from within suddenly broke, and Snout was leaning over the arm of a tall chair and looking straight into my eyes.
"Hello there," he said.
"I read your note. I'd like to talk. Can I come over?"
"Sure. Right now?"
"Yes."
"Fine. Will you have company?"
"No." His gaunt, sunburned face with thick wrinkles on the forehead, tilting in the convex glass screen like some bizarre fish peering from its aquarium, assumed an ambiguous expression.
"Well, well," he said. "I'll be expecting you."
"We can go, darling," I began with a not entirely natural animation, as I entered the cabin through swathes of red light, beyond which I could only make out Hare's looming silhouette. My voice failed me. She was sitting clinging to the chair, her elbows locked under the armrest. Whether she hadn't heard my footsteps in time, or hadn't been able to release her terrified grip quickly enough to take on a normal pose, whatever the reason, suffice it to say that I saw her for a moment grappling with the incomprehensible power that lay concealed within her, and my heart was overcome with a blind fury mingled with pity. We walked in silence down the long corridor, passing its various sections that were painted in different colored enamel, something the architects had intended to lend variety to life inside the armored shell. From far off I saw the open door of the radio station. It let out a long band of red light into the corridor, since the sun reached there as well. I glanced at Hare, who didn't even try to smile. I could see how the whole way there she was intently preparing for the struggle with herself. The approaching effort had already changed her face, which was pale and seemed to have grown smaller. 10 or 15 steps from the door, she came to a halt. I turned towards her. With her fingertips, she gave me a gentle push to tell me to keep walking. All at once, my plans—Snout, the experiment, the whole station—it all seemed nothing to me compared to the torment she was now facing. I felt like a torturer, and I was about to turn back when a human shadow appeared in the broad strip of sunlight bending against the wall.
I quickened my pace and entered the cabin. Snout was just across the threshold, as if he'd been coming to meet me. The red sun was directly behind him, and a crimson glare seemed to radiate from his gray hair. We looked at each other for a good while without saying anything. He seemed to be studying my face. I was blinded by the light from the window and couldn't see his expression. I walked past him and stood by the high console, bristling with the curving stems of microphones. He turned slowly around on the spot, following me calmly with that slight twist of the mouth of his that, almost without changing at all, became now a smile, now a grimace of exhaustion. Without taking his eyes off me, he went up to the metal cabinet that occupied the entire wall, in front of which, on either side, were heaps of spare radio parts, thermic batteries, and tools that seemed to have been piled there hurriedly and chaotically. He pulled up a chair and sat down, leaning his head against the enameled door of the cabinet. The silence we'd kept up till now was becoming strange, to say the least. I listened intently to it, concentrating on the quiet that filled the corridor where Hari was waiting, from where there came not the slightest murmur. "When will the two of you be ready?" I asked.
"We could even start today, but the recording will take some time."
"Recording? You mean the encephalogram?"
"Right. I mean, you agreed. Is there a problem?"
His voice trailed off. "No, not at all."
"Go on,"
Snout said, when the silence again began to gather between us. "She already knows. About herself." I had dropped my voice almost to a whisper. He raised his eyebrows.
"Is that so?"
I had the impression he wasn't really surprised. And why was he pretending? All at once, I no longer felt like talking, but I forced myself. Let it be loyalty, I thought to myself, if nothing more. It seems she got an inkling after our conversation in the library. She observed me, put two and two together, then she found Gabarian's tape recorder and listened to the tape. He didn't change position, leaning the whole time against the cabinet, but a tiny glint appeared in his eye. From where I stood at the console, I had a clear view of the open door to the corridor. I lowered my voice even more. "Last night, while I was asleep, she tried to kill herself. Liquid oxygen." There was a sudden rustling sound, like a draft of air blowing through loose sheets of paper. I froze and listened hard for what was happening in the corridor, but the source of the noise was closer. It scratched like a mouse. A mouse? How ridiculous. There were no mice here. I watched Snout from the corner of my eye.
"Go on," he said calmly.
"It goes without saying she didn't succeed. In any case, she knows who she is."
"Why are you telling me this?"
he suddenly asked. To begin with, I didn't know what to say. "I want you to be informed. I want you to know how things are," I mumbled.
"I warned you."
"You mean to say that you knew?" I said, raising my voice despite myself.
"No, of course not. But I told you how it is. Every guest is almost a ghost when they arrive, aside from a hodgepodge of memories and images taken from their atom. They're basically empty. The longer they're with you here, the more human they become, and the more independent, within certain limits, of course. That's why the longer it goes on, the harder it is."
He broke off. He looked askance at me and asked casually,
"She knows everything?"
"Yes, I already told you."
"Everything, including that she was already here once before and that you..."
"No," he smiled.
"Kelvin, listen, if things have gone that far, then what do you actually mean to do? Leave the station?"
"Yes."
"With her?"
"Yes." He was silent, as if weighing up his reply, but there was something more in his silence. What was it? Once again that imperceptible breeze rustled, as if right behind a thin wall. He shifted in his chair.
"Very good," he said. "Why are you staring at me like that? Did you think I'd stand in your way?" "You can do whatever you want, my dear fellow. Now we'd be in fine shape if, on top of everything else, we started using force here. I've no intention of trying to dissuade you. I'll only say one thing. In an inhuman situation, You're trying to behave like a human being. That may be admirable, but it's also futile. Though, in fact, I'm not even sure it's admirable. I'm not sure something foolish can also be admired. But that's beside the point. You're backing out of any further experiments. You want to go and take her with you, is that it?
Yes.
But that's also, an experiment, don't you think?
How do you mean? Whether she'll be able to? Well, if she's with me, I don't see why not. I was speaking ever more slowly till I broke off. Snout gave a soft sigh.
We're all sticking our heads in the sand here, Kelvin. But at least we're aware of it. And we're not trying to act noble.
I'm not acting anything.
All right, I didn't mean to insult you. I take back what I said about being noble. But the thing about hiding our heads in the sand is still true. You're doing it in an especially dangerous way. You're deceiving yourself and her, and yourself again. Do you know the stabilization conditions for systems built of neutrino matter?
No. And neither do you. No one does.
Of course. But we do know one thing, that such a system is unstable and can only exist if it has a constant supply of energy. I know that from Sartorius. The energy creates a warped stabilizing field. The question is that field external, or is its source located inside the guest's body? You get the difference.
Yes, I said slowly. If it's external, then she... Then such a...
Then when the system becomes separated from Solaris, it will fall apart,
he finished for me.
We can't predict it, though you already conducted an experiment. The rocket you sent up, it's still orbiting, you know. In a spare moment, I even calculated its path. You could fly up into orbit and check what happened with a passenger.
Are you mad? I hissed.
You think so? Well, what if we brought it back down here, the rocket? That can be done. It's controlled remotely. We'll guide it out of its orbit and...
Enough.
Not that either? Then there's one other way, a very simple one. It wouldn't have to land at the station. It could stay in orbit. We could simply make radio contact. If she's alive, she'll say something, and...
The oxygen will have run out there long ago, I stammered.
Maybe she doesn't need oxygen. Shall we try? Snout, snout! Kelvin, Kelvin, he mimicked, angry. Think about what kind of person you are. Who are you trying to make happy here, or save? Yourself? Her? Which one? This one or the other one? Do you lack the courage to save both of them? You see yourself where this leads. I'm telling you for the last time, this, here, this... is a situation beyond morality.
All at once I heard the same scratching sound as before, as if someone were scraping their fingernails down the wall. I don't know why I was overcome by a kind of passive, miry calm. It was as if I were looking at the whole situation, the two of us, everything from a great distance, through the wrong end of a telescope. It was all tiny, rather funny, of little consequence. All right, then. I said, so according to you, what should I do? Get rid of her? Then tomorrow another one just like her will appear, right? And again, and like that day after day, for how long? What for? What will that give me? Or you, or Sartorius, or the station?
No, you answer me first. You'll take off with her, and let's say you'll witness the following transformation. In a few minutes, you'll see before you...
What? I said sneeringly. A monster? A demon?
No. Ordinary. The most ordinary death throes. Have you already come to believe they're immortal? Well, let me assure you, they die. What will you do then? Will you come back for a copy?
Stop it! I roared, clenching my fists.
He gazed at me with an expression of indulgent mockery in his narrowed eyes. Oh, I'm the one who should stop. You know something, if I were you, I'd give this conversation a rest. Find something else to do instead. You could go and give the ocean a good whipping, for example, to teach it a lesson. What is your problem? If you...
He made a playful gesture of farewell with his hand, at the same time raising his eyes slowly towards the ceiling, as if following a receding figure.
"Then you'll be the bad guy, and otherwise you won't. Smile when you feel like howling, act happy and composed when you want to gnaw your knuckles, then you won't be a bad guy. What if it's impossible not to be in this place, What then? You'll rage in front of Snout, who's responsible for everything, huh? Then on top of everything else, you're an idiot, my friend."
"You're talking about yourself," I said, my head lowered. I love her."
"Who? Your memory?"
"No, her. I told you what she tried to do. There's many a real person wouldn't do that."
"You admit it yourself when you say..."
"Don't catch me in my words."
"All right, so she loves you, and you want to love her. It's not the same thing."
"You're wrong."
"Kelvin, I'm sorry, but you're the one who brought up your private affairs. You don't love her, you do love her. She's prepared to give up her life. You too. It's all very moving, very beautiful, sublime, whatever. But there's no room for any of that here. No room. Understand?" "No, you don't want to understand. You refuse to understand. Forces beyond our control have involved you in a cyclical process of which she is a part. A phase, a repeating rhythm. If you were being pursued by something hideous that was prepared to do anything for you, you'd not hesitate to get rid of it, right?"
"Right."
Then maybe that's exactly why she isn't hideous. Does that tie your hands? That's what it's about, that your hands should be tied."
"One more hypothesis to add to the million others in the library. Come off it, Snout. Now, I don't want to talk about this with you."
"All right. You started it. But just remember, she's basically a mirror, reflecting part of your brain. If she's wonderful, it's because your memories are wonderful. You provided the recipe. A cyclical process. Don't forget."
"So what do you want from me? You want me to get rid of her?" "I already asked you. Why should I do that? You didn't answer."
"Then I'll answer you now. I didn't ask for this conversation. I didn't go poking around in your business. I'm not ordering or forbidding you to do anything, and I wouldn't even if I could. It was you. You came here and laid everything out, and do you know why? No! So as to get it off your chest, dump it on someone else. I know that burden, my friend. That's right, don't interrupt! I'm not standing in your way at all, but you want me to stand in your way. If I presented obstacles, maybe you'd smash my head in, but then at least you'd be dealing with me with someone made of the same flesh and blood as yourself, and you'd feel human too. But this way, you can't handle it, and that's why you're having this discussion with me, and in fact, with yourself. You forgot to mention you'd double up in pain if she were to suddenly vanish. No, don't say any more."
"You got a nerve. Out of simple loyalty, I came to let you know that I intend to leave the station with her," I said, repulsing his attack, though it sounded unconvincing even to me. Snout shrugged.
"It's quite possible you need to stick to that story. If I said anything at all in this business, it's only because you're rising higher and higher, and a fall from high up, as I'm sure you understand. Come up to Sartorius's tomorrow morning around 9, will you?"
"To Sartorius's?" I replied in surprise. "He doesn't let anyone in. You said he can't even be reached on the phone."
"Yeah, he's gotten it together now somehow or other. We don't talk about it, you know. That's a whole other matter. Well, never mind that. You'll come tomorrow."
"I will," I murmured. I stared at Snout. His left hand was hidden, as if by chance, behind the door of a locker. When had it opened? That must have been some time ago, except that in the heat of the conversation, which I'd found so onerous, I'd not paid any attention to it. It looked so unnatural, as if he were hiding something there, or as if someone had a hold of his hand. I moistened my lips. "Snout, what is it?"
"Go now," he said quietly and very calmly. "Go."
I went, closing the door behind me in the remains of the red glow. Hari was sitting on the floor 10 yards away, right by the wall. She jumped up when she saw me.
"You see?"
she said, looking at me with shining eyes. It worked, Chris. I'm so pleased. Perhaps it'll get better and better.
I'm sure it will, I answered distractedly. We walked back to our cabin while I puzzled over that stupid locker. So he was concealing, and that entire conversation. My cheeks started to burn so badly I rubbed them despite myself. Lord, this was madness. And what had we actually decided? Nothing. Oh, right, tomorrow morning. Suddenly I was overcome by fear, almost as powerful as the previous night. My encephalogram, a complete recording of all my cerebral processes, converted into the oscillations of a bundle of rays to be sent down below, into the depths of that elusive, boundless monster. How did he put it? If she vanished, you'd suffer terribly, right? An encephalogram is a total recording, including subconscious processes. What if I want her to disappear, to perish? Otherwise, why would I have been so horrified when she survived that terrible attempt? Can a person be responsible for his own subconscious? If I'm not responsible for it, then who could be? What foolishness. Why the hell had I agreed the recording should be of me? Of course, I could examine it beforehand, but I wouldn't be able to read it anyway. No one would. Specialists can determine only what the subject was thinking about, and even then they're just generalizations. For example, they can say he was solving math problems, but they have no idea which kind. They say it's not possible to know because the encephalogram is a random combination of a whole mass of simultaneous processes, only some of which have a mental underpinning. And the subconscious parts? Well, these they're unwilling to discuss at all. So they're a very long way from being able to decipher a person's memories, suppressed or otherwise. Well, then why am I so afraid? I myself had told Hare earlier that the experiment wouldn't do any good. Because if our neurophysiologists can't read a recording, then how could this utterly alien, black, liquid monster? Yet it had entered into me. I have no idea how. It had sifted through my entire memory and found its most painful atom. How could that be doubted? And without any assistance, without any radiation transmission, it had broken through the double hermetic plating, the thick armoring of the station, had found my body inside it, and had made off with its plunder.
Chris? Said Hare quietly.
I was standing at the window, gazing with unseeing eyes at the beginnings of the night. The stars were veiled by a delicate film, faint at that geographic latitude, a thin, even covering of clouds that were so high the sun, from far below the horizon, pervaded them with the subtlest silvery pink glow. If she disappears afterwards, that will mean I wanted it, because I killed her. Should I not go there tomorrow? They couldn't force me. But what would I tell them? Not that. I couldn't. No, I needed to pretend, to lie all the time, always. Though that was because there may have been thoughts in me, intentions, hopes, cruel, wonderful, murderous, yet of which I was quite unaware. Human beings set out to encounter other worlds, other civilizations, without having fully gotten to know their own hidden recesses, their blind alleys, well shafts, dark barricaded doors. To give her up to them, out of shame? To give her up only because I'd run out of courage?
Chris,
Hare whispered even more softly than before. I felt, rather than heard, her coming noiselessly up to me, and I pretended I hadn't noticed. At that moment I wanted to be alone. I had to be alone. I still hadn't found strength inside myself. I'd reached no decision, no resolution. As I stared at the darkening sky, at the stars that were only a spectral shadow of terrestrial stars, I stood there motionless. In the emptiness that was gradually taking the place of the whirlwind of thoughts from a moment before, there arose, without words, the dead, indifferent certainty that deep down, in a place I could not reach, I had already chosen. And pretending that nothing had happened, I didn't even have the strength to despise myself.